Windows down, music up. Get ready to hit the road in a new Chevy SUV or truck. Chevy is a name you know and trust. It's Chevy as American as apple pie and baseball. Check out the full line of Chevy vehicles at your local Chevy dealer. Chevy, drive Chicago.
We are going to be talking about two cases in the news. If you have any questions or comments, 312-981-7200 or text to that same number, 312-981-7200. I'm going to give out my office information. If anyone has a question about a legal matter or need a referral to a lawyer or have an idea for a show segment, please reach out and give me a call or better yet, an email, WGN@AskKarenConti.com, WGN@AskKarenConti.com, 312-332-7800. But let's get to our next and final guest, Damon Sharonis. He is a regular here. He's always here to break down the law. He is a founder of Sharonis and Parente, very aggressive and effective advocates for people accused of all kinds of crimes, federal, white-collar, violent crimes, drug and sex crimes, and he's been involved in some of the high-profile cases across the nation. Damon, thanks again for joining me. I'll always appreciate your time.
Happy Sunday, Karen. Thanks for having me.
Happy Sunday to you. So I want to talk about the Broadview 6, and I'm sorry if people are a little tired of discussing this, but this is a really important case. It's gotten national attention, and there's some more fallout this week that I want to discuss. Your firm represented one of the Broadview 6 in a case that it was six political activists and local candidates who were indicted on federal felony conspiracy charges following an anti-ICE demonstration in Broadview, Illinois. All of the charges were dismissed with prejudice, which means they cannot be brought again due to severe, what I consider to be severe prosecutorial misconduct during the grand jury phase. There's been some fallout this week. But let's, you know what, I want to educate our listeners a little bit, and maybe you know some of this, but Damon, tell us a grand jury 101. Why do we have a grand jury? And tell us, set the scene, what happens during a grand jury process?
Grand juries are really investigative bodies that are called by the government in order to bring charges against citizens. And historically, you know, if you go back in time to when, you know, our founding fathers recognized the importance of it, it's because in England, kings oftentimes would just hold people, charge people at their whim. So the grand jury is really supposed to act as a buffer between the government who wants to charge the citizen and the citizen. So normal people, everyday citizens sit and they listen to evidence and they decide whether or not the government has probable cause to go forward with charges. So historically, they're a very important part of our country because they're supposed to protect citizens from overreaching governments or the whims of prosecutors.
But it's not really that hard to get a grand jury indictment in many cases because the defendant doesn't get to be there, right?
No, it's done in secret. It's done. The prosecutor calls the show. They're the ones who present the evidence. So as you can imagine, they have a lot of responsibility to be fair in their presentation because there is no adversarial testing of it as it's going on.
And there's no judge either.
There's no judge. I mean, the prosecutor literally runs the show. You know, in a regular trial, as you know, when the case is over before, you know, it goes to the jury or the closing arguments, the judge reads the law to the jury. During a trial, the judge calls balls and strikes. They don't have that in the grand jury. The prosecutors are responsible for explaining the law, for presenting evidence, and for doing it in a fair way.
The Broadview 6 case resulted in all of the charges being dropped because there was an acknowledgement that there were improprieties in the grand jury process. Can you just highlight what those were and tell us how serious they were? Because I think some people look and they say, oh, so yeah, that's not, you know, maybe they cut a few corners. But to me, these seem to be very, very serious violations.
I agree. And I think more importantly, Judge Perry agreed. You know, she was a former federal prosecutor herself. She was also a state's attorney. And she, you know, said in court that she was shocked by this and something along the lines that she'd never seen this type of conduct before. So there was a number of different sort of aspects of misconduct. One of them was vouching for the case. In other words, hey, you know, I would never bring a case unless I believed in it. You guys trust me. you know, that's one of the things a prosecutor can't do. You can't vouch for the, you know, legitimacy of a case. Grand jurors were pushing back and saying, I believe a crock of SH, you know what, and those grand jurors were being dismissed. The law was not being properly read to the grand jury. So it was, you know, there was a number of different things, but the vouching and getting rid of jurors who, you know, weren't on your side and the law not being given to them properly are pretty much the main things. It was sort of a free-for-all in there. And, you know, that's the main reason that Judge Barry just said enough's enough.
And at some point there was an inkling with you and your law partner that there was some impropriety, and the grand jury transcripts were actually produced. There was a lot of redactions, but then the redactions were unredacted, and we discovered what was going on here. So grand jury transcripts, is it normal that they stay secret throughout the entire time?
So normally, if somebody testifies in front of the grand jury and then that person is going to be called to testify at trial, you're entitled to get those grand jury transcripts. But short of that, oftentimes grand jury transcripts never see the light of day, especially the colloquy between the grand jurors and the prosecutor and the grand jury, and they sort of read the law. That stuff is not given to us. And that's really where a lot of the issues occurred in this case. So, no, I mean, it's secret, and the reason for it being secret is, one, grand jury transcripts should be kept secret because if somebody is not charged, you would not want the public to know that, you know, they were sort of on the government's radar. And plus, you want to protect the secrecy of the grand juries and the privacy of the grand jurors themselves. So there's a lot of reasons for it to be secret, but I think those reasons are often trumped by what could be misconduct or problems in the grand jury, and there are workarounds where they don't need to be disclosed to the public, but the defense lawyers, I think, should be able to get their hands on it, even if it's attorney's eyes only, to review what happens in the grand jury to be able to make these sort of motions.
It makes sense to me because, again, you know, you can ascribe all kinds of good motives to all lawyers and everyone in the process, but there are going to be people who cut the corners. And let's just talk about the fallout this week of this case. There were charges completely unrelated to the Broadview 6. What do you know about those charges, and why were they dropped?
Sure. So it was basically a COVID fraud case tied to Loretto Hospital. It was a high profile case. And essentially, after the Broadview case sort of fell apart, the government started reviewing the transcripts and the other prosecutions brought by the same prosecutor. So the link between the Broadview 6 and the Loretto case was the same U.S. attorney presented the cases to the grand jury. So once they did that, they reviewed the transcripts and turned them over to the lawyers for the defendants in the Loretto case, and they filed another bombshell motion saying the same type of misconduct and maybe even more misconduct had taken place in front of that grand jury. And what happened is, and one of the problems, Karen, is that the government, and that was a really big case, the Loretto case.
Yeah, it was millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah, and Judge Coleman, who's a great judge, and she's a federal judge who handled the Loretto case, basically said, we're having a hearing. Everybody is going to testify from the U.S. attorney on down. So the federal government was left with the decision, do we want to put these people on the witness stand, our prosecutors, and have defense attorneys have at them and try to get to the bottom of the misconduct, or do we just dismiss the charges and walk away from them? So what the government decided is they did not want to have a hearing, and they dismissed with prejudice a very significant case. Now, I don't know. I'm not saying anything about the merits of the case on their own. I think the government had a pretty difficult case to begin with, but they did not want to call the U.S. attorney and everybody else who was in the case to have them subject to, you know, probing as to what happened. So they just walked away from it. And there's going to be more, I think.
Well, I think so, too. And if I were sitting, you know, in a prison cell somewhere, or if I were a defense lawyer, I would be saying, were those prosecutors on my case? And did they do the same thing? Because if they were doing in these two cases, what would have stopped them from the improprieties in the other cases? I mean, this could be like a whole snowball.
We did that, Karen. You know, we had another client who pled guilty and was serving time in jail, and it was the same prosecutor, and we just filed a motion to get the grand jury transcripts. And the judge in that case said, this is very unusual, but you're going to get them, or at least I'm going to get them to look at them in camera to see if there is any impropriety. So I think what's really happening in the federal system, which is rare and odd, as you know, is that the federal government, who usually have what's called the presumption of regularity, in other words, they get the benefit of the doubt, they've sort of lost that. And, you know, federal judges are really doing their job within the separation of powers and saying, look, we're going to police this to the best we can and ensure that these defendants who come in front of us were treated fairly in front of the grand jury. And that's what's starting to happen, and I expect it to continue to happen.
And that's a good thing. The taint on the prosecutor's office is a bad thing, but I think shining the light on it is good, like you said. Damon Charonis is here. We're going to come back, and we're going to talk about a case that was in the news, Carmelo Anthony case. Let's talk about the Carmelo Anthony case. If you haven't heard about it, let me give you the quick rundown of what the facts are. And I think it's important because it illustrates a few points in the law that I think you will find interesting. So Anthony, Carmelo Anthony was accused of murdering a kid named Austin Metcalf during a high school track meet. They were both 17 years old. They were attending different high schools. They apparently did not know each other. There was a tent somewhere set up near the track meet. Anthony came into the tent. He was asked to leave because he wasn't a member of the team. The victim pushed him, and Anthony took out a knife and stabbed Metcalf in the chest and killed him. He was charged with first-degree murder, and there was also an option, is my understanding, for a manslaughter conviction as well. He pled not guilty, asserted self-defense, and the case was tried, and he was found guilty of first-degree murder. Damon, let's just start with just general definitions of murder, manslaughter, and self-defense.
Murder is the intentional killing of another. You know, you caused the victim's death and you intended to do it, or you intended to cause serious bodily injury and it created a high risk of death. So, and it was not legally justified. So murder is sort of what you think about, but manslaughter is when we get into things that are a little more complicated. You know, in Illinois, we have sort of what's called the heat of passion defense. If you're provoked, right, and you don't have a period of time where you can cool off and get yourself back together. Or, and I guess the best example is the Laquan McDonald case. As we all remember, the police officer was found guilty of second-degree murder, which means in his mind he was acting under self-defense, but it was unreasonable, right? He subjectively believed it was reasonable, but it wasn't. So those are really the distinctions between murder and manslaughter. And then self-defense is what it sounds like. You're using defense against an unlawful imminent battery. But when you use deadly force, which is what was used in this case, you need to be facing some sort of significant injury or sort of death yourself or great bodily injury. So that's sort of a quick breakdown of the issues in this case.
So my understanding is that the options that the jury had were, number one, acquittal. And the idea was that he said it was in self-defense. He was appropriately defending himself, so he would walk free under that scenario. If it was first-degree murder, as you said, intentional crime, that's murder, and then manslaughter would be some sort of imperfect self-defense or heat of passion or the like. And the jury found the most serious crime here, first-degree murder. What were the facts here? It looks like the jury came back fairly quickly, about 2.5 hours, which sounds like a quick amount of time. What do you see were the facts that would justify a first-degree murder conviction?
Well, I think the issue in this case was that the jury thought that whatever he did was just not reasonable. He was pushed, and the response, according to the facts that I've read, was he didn't push the kid back. He didn't punch the kid. He took a knife out of his bag and he stabbed him in the chest. And I think one of the things that came out of trial was Mr. Anthony said, touch me again and see what happens. So, and I've got cases like this. I've got a similar case right now. You know, the issue really becomes, was what the defendant Anthony did commensurate with the provocation? And the short answer is it's hard to establish that it's reasonable to stab somebody in the chest if they don't have a weapon, if they're not attacking you, if they're not beating you. Pushing somebody does not normally equate to I have the right then to stab them. Now, if the other person had a weapon or if the other person was choking him, then you're getting closer to being able to use deadly force. But imagine, you know, how many people get pushed on a playground, how many people get pushed at sporting events. You cannot respond with a stab. I do think, potentially, second-degree murder may have been the better verdict. Okay, he unreasonably believed he had to do this, or his passion was so provoked, but the jury just said no, it was first degree murder.
And he didn't testify. And again, you know, it's easy to Monday morning a quarterback on this. Do you think it was a good idea that he didn't testify? I mean, he was 17 at the time the crime was committed, only 19 when he went to trial. What would you have advised him, do you think, knowing what you know about the case?
Not knowing all the facts, but what I do know, it is very difficult. I don't want to say impossible, but very difficult to win a self-defense case without your client testifying, especially if the act is not caught on video or completely caught on video, because you want the jury, you want to put them in the shoes of the defendant, and the defendant has to explain what he thought, the way he acted, why it was reasonable. And you also want the jury to get to know the kid, to think, okay, this isn't a bad kid. This isn't a kid who's got a lot of problems. Seems like a nice young man, and maybe give him the benefit of the doubt. So to not have a defendant testify, and again, I don't know all the facts of the case. I'm sure his lawyers were very good, and I may have made the same decision had I been presented with the facts. But in a typical self-defense case, you want the jury to hear from your client so they can know what was going on in your client's head.
In this case, this was always surprising to me. The jury had the responsibility of sentencing the kid. And and that never happens in Illinois, right?
It does not happen in Illinois, and I don't know if I would have wanted a jury to sentence somebody in this case either.
Yeah, I mean, and what was interesting to me is that he was convicted. They took him away, and then they brought him right back in, and the sentencing started right away. And my understanding is the only witness was Anthony's mother, who got up on the stand and said, "I love my son, and I'll stand behind him," or whatever she said. Do you think there could have been other evidence that would have helped him in his sentencing? I mean, I was thinking of this, Damon. This kid was 17 years old. I mean, his brain is not fully formed. He was an honor student. I mean, again, not to say that this makes it better or makes what he did to take away any of the blame, but he was an honor student. He was captain of a track and football team. He held two jobs. He had no priors. Like, could that have been presented to a jury? And do you think that could have helped in the sentencing?
Absolutely. Now, in a case like this, when you know a jury is going to sentence, or maybe even a judge, you work on the mitigation while you're getting ready for the trial. In a case like this, you'd want his school records. You'd want any medical records if they were important. You'd want teachers from his school testifying. You'd want to put on almost like a death penalty, Karen. You're familiar. You've done those cases.
Yes.
You'd almost want to put on a mitigation phase like that. Because, you know, the mom is going to say nice things about the kid, and I'm sure they were heartfelt, and I'm sure he was a good kid, right? I mean, this is not, you know, this does not sound like a bad kid. It sounds like a horrible situation where one family has lost somebody forever and the other has lost a child for decades. But you really want the jury to be able to look at the human being and the history and all of the background to try to put the best foot forward to get a better sentence than what they got. Absolutely.
We have literally 30 seconds, but I have to say there were no African Americans on the jury. The prosecutors dismissed three potential jurors who were African American. They had excuses, reasons to do it. Do you think that this is ground for appeal?
Well, they should have been what's called a Batson challenge, which means you cannot get rid of somebody, or you cannot strike a juror just for race. So hopefully they made those challenges. And then, you know, the prosecution would have to come up with what's called a race-neutral reason. So I absolutely hope those issues were preserved for appeal.
Thank you so much for joining us. Damon Sharonis, how can people reach you?
Again, Sharonis Law, CHERONISLAW.com. And thanks again, Karen.